That was Sonny Stitt leading off with Sonny's Brook, and right behind him, Booker Irvin on tenor sax, Don Patterson on organ, Billy James on drums. That was recorded in 1964. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Wednesday, November the 27th. A program I hope you'll find useful today. Last week, we reported the militarization of police departments all over the United States through a very low-key program under the auspices of the Defense Department that arms them with military-grade equipment used for warfare. That was on the November the 21st program, if you want to check the archives. Today we're going to hear the other side of that, which is the additional information that makes sense when we start to figure out why is it that police departments are beginning to militarize. Slowly but surely they are. Well, we'll be hearing from a chief strategist, a former chief strategist, I should say, for the State Department, on counterterrorism and guerrilla warfare, who says that wars in the very near future will be fought largely in sprawling coastal cities and in underdeveloped areas of the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, and Asia. And we want to pay attention to what he says because we can see it in formation. It is not just so blatantly obvious, but it is a creeping militarization that is occurring, but slowly and surely it is occurring. He gave this talk, he actually wrote this book, Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. He had written other books as well in that vein. One was called The Accidental Guerrilla, one called Counterinsurgency, and, of course, the current book, Out of the Mountains. He spoke to a group at the Marines Memorial Club in San Francisco on October the 16th. His name is David John Kilcullen. He is Australian. He now heads up a strategy and design, meaning military design and strategy consulting firm. And he was a chief strategist for the U.S. State Department. He had worked as a chief strategist with General Petraeus and during the Iraq War, and he had been also a special advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. He had been an advisor to various presidential committees dealing with intelligence and so forth. And what he is saying quite casually is very disturbing, but I thought I would share that with you as the corollary to the presentation that we heard during the information shared with Elizabeth Beavers of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, who was talking to us about the upsurge in militarization of the police departments all over the country. Take a listen. Here he is.
The time. So let me just give you the sort of background to why I wrote the book and the main ideas that are in it. I started writing this in September of 2009, right after actually the most recent time that I got ambushed in Afghanistan, which was in eastern Nangarhar province, a place called Dara-e-Noor district, and it was one of these classic Afghanistan ambush scenarios. Most people in Afghanistan live, in eastern Afghanistan anyway, live in mountain valleys. They live in these little villages strung out along the floor of valleys. Nobody really lives high on the mountains. They all live down in the valley floor. And there's usually only one road that runs down the middle of the valley. So if you go up that valley in the morning, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody knows exactly where you're going to be. Okay, can people hear me all right? Yep. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody knows exactly where you're going to be, which is, you know, driving down the road in the middle of the valley. And so I got ambushed at about sort of 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I remember thinking to myself, middle of the valley. And so I got ambushed at about sort of 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I remember thinking to myself, this is a pretty bad ambush. You know, I've been involuntarily in a lot of ambushes over the last decade or so, and actually I taught ambushing at the tactics school as an infantry instructor. So I was thinking to myself, you know, if these guys were my students, I'd probably fail them on their ambush plan. It was just very badly put together. I was like, what, you know, they're having a bad day or what's going on? And I realized after about a day of thinking about it, this was not a Taliban ambush at all. What this was a particular village in the valley that was pissed about how much aid we'd given to a couple of other villages, and they were essentially sending us a message about how they felt about our aid prioritization, which seems like a crazy overreaction, right? But if you spend any time in Afghanistan, you'll know that that happens all the time. And it turns out that the assistance we give to Afghanistan, which is about 14 times the size of the annual Afghan government budget, is actually responsible for a very substantial amount of the violence that we see on the ground. I'm going to give a shout out to Will Upshur and John Rajinsky here, who we worked together in southern Afghanistan in 2010, 2011, doing exactly this, trying to pull apart the sort of surface layer of what you see in the conflict and look beyond and behind that to what's actually going on that you don't necessarily see you know, immediately as you look at the violence. What I've tried to do in the book is to start with that sort of conversation that I was having in my head in Afghanistan in about 2009, where I started to say, you know what, there's a deeper level here than just counterinsurgency doctrine. This is not just about an insurgency that's fighting a government. It's also about a bunch of villages that are trying to gain authority over other villages. It's about the direction of contracting money and the direction of aid assistance and the way people fight over that. And it's also about the sort of dynamics of conflict that are common to not only insurgencies but also gangs and militias and all kinds of non-state armed groups that compete to control populations essentially across the planet 24/7, whether you be in a war zone or not. But as I wrote the book, I really started to realize that what we're doing in Afghanistan is something of a geographical fluke. And that's what actually most of the book ended up being about, which is if you look for the last 10 years at what we've been doing, we have gotten really, really good at dealing with non-state armed groups in a very traditional, very xenophobic society in remote rural villages in this kind of landlocked mountainous environment, like the environment that I was talking about where I got ambushed, where the population density is very low, the level of connectivity is basically non-existent, and people are kind of scattered in these little remote outposts. if you look to the future of the planet and you think what's actually going to happen after Afghanistan is over and after we move on to the sort of next round of conflict, what you find is that that's not what the future of the environment is going to look like at all. We're going to be much more in an urban, littoral, that is coastal, and very, very highly connected environment. We'll be doing a lot of the same things we've been doing for the last decade. 80% of conflict across the planet is and always has been irregular in nature. That is, one of the main combatants is almost always a non-state armed group, and that pattern goes right back to the, you know, the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815. More precisely, in US military history, there's a really specific and repeated pattern that we do a large-scale or long-duration insurgency or stabilization operation about once every 20 to 25 years, and we do little ones, sort of the size of Kosovo or Sierra Leone or East Timor, about every 5 to 10 years, and that pattern goes right back to the middle of the 19th century, and it's completely independent of policymakers' preferences. So I had somebody say to me the other day, well, didn't the president already say that we're going to get out of this business? And I'm like, he did. He's the 7th president in the last 80 years to make basically exactly the same statement. And there's no detectable effect of what the, whether the president wants to do it or not on how often we do this stuff. So looking forward, we're going to be doing kind of more of the same stuff, but the environment in which we're going to be operating looks very different. So four big factors drive that environment, and I've tried to think about what is the shape of the future environment and what impact will it have. And three of them are old, one of them's new, and it's the fourth one that I really want to focus on. But let me cover the first three, just to get them out of the way. So the four factors are urbanization, population growth, littoralization, which is the tendency for things to cluster on coastlines, and then connectivity, which is the new factor. So if we start with population growth, at the beginning of the European Industrial Revolution in the middle of the 18th century, the population of the planet in 1750 was about 750 million people. It took 150 years for that population to double. So by 1900, we got to 1.5 billion people. We then doubled again in only 60 years to 3 billion people by 1960. We doubled again to hit 6 billion by the end of the last century. And in the dozen years or so since then, we've added slightly more than a billion people. So today the population of the planet is roughly 7 billion. So you see this accelerating pattern of population growth since the Industrial Revolution. Now, people who do the projections and look at where population and demographics is going suggest that we're not going to keep on rising at the same level forever. We're going to top out at around the middle of the century at about 9.5 billion people on the planet. But that's still about 2.5 billion more people than we have now. In that same time frame, we're likely to see a reasonably or a really significant level of urbanization. So again, if we go back to the Industrial Revolution, in 1800, about 2% of people lived in a city of a million or more. So 2% of people on the planet were in a large city. By 1900, it was 10%. By 1950, it was 25%. By 2008, it was 50%. And the projection is we're looking at somewhere around 75% of people on the planet living in a major city by the middle of this century. So again, roughly the current population of the planet will be the urban population by the middle of the century. The third factor is littoralization. And it's a fact based, I think, just in the mechanics of moving heavy stuff, that most cities have traditionally been on coastlines. If you look at megacities in particular, that is cities of a population of 10 million or more, 21 out of the 25 largest cities on the planet are either directly on a coastline or on a major river delta. There's only four cities on the planet that are not, that is four megacities: Moscow, Beijing, Tehran, and Mexico City. All the other major 10 million or more cities on the planet are coastal cities. Why is that? Because it's a lot easier to move heavy things by water than by land. And so trade has traditionally been seaborne or riverborne, and so cities have tended to aggregate around logistics hubs. And so as a consequence, because people move to existing cities, already the population of the planet is very heavily littoral. 80% of people on the planet today live within 50 miles of a coastline. So littoral, urban, crowded. Those three factors, extraordinarily well understood 20 years ago. And the Marine Corps in particular had guys like General Myatt from this club, or General Krulak, who talked about the three-block war and the urban littoral. There were guys in the Army like Ralph Peters and Robert Scales, I'm talking about people that are sort of military theorists of the 1990s, who wrote all about this stuff, you know, way back. Very, very well understood. But what's happened is in the 10 years or so since 9/11, or the 12 years since 9/11, two things have happened. One, the military has been dragged off into this environment that I've been talking about, the landlocked, remote, rural environment of Afghanistan. And secondly, the planet has changed in that time. In the year 2000, there were only 30,000 cell phones in Nigeria. Today, there are 113 million. When I was doing my field work in Mogadishu for the book, I was walking around on the street, essentially interviewing people and talking to people about how they make a living. 24% of Somalis own and use a cell phone. 20 years ago, last week, there was a big fight in Mogadishu that's been memorialized in a movie called Black Hawk Down, which some of you may have seen. That fight happened around the Bakara market, which is a major market in downtown Mogadishu. When I was there, I was talking to traders in that market, where the Somali shilling, which is a currency that survived for 20 years without a state or a central bank, is traded on a floating interest rate. And the way that it works is they have computers set up, they're on the internet, they understand the international currency rates, and they trade the currency on a currency trading floor on the bottom floor of that market, and five times a day they update the trading rate of the Somali shilling, and they fire it out by text message to several thousand traders who are all out in the city, and that's how they work the trades that they do. Now, Somalis have always been traders, but until recently they weren't trading, you know, international stocks or managing remittance money in St. Paul, Minnesota, or in Scandinavia. That's what we see now. And in fact, a lot of what I saw on the ground supported something that a lot of economists are saying now, which is that access to the international trading economy, which is dependent on connectivity, has become one of the really major elements in urban growth. It's replaced agricultural surplus as one of the reasons why people move to cities. Thinking about it in sort of scientific terms, it's kind of like an osmotic gradient, right, where you've got a salty solution on one side of a membrane and a non-salty solution on the other. Ions are going to migrate from one side to the other. If you have a connectivity differential between urban environments and rural environments, people are going to move to where the connectivity is. And that's what we're seeing. Because if you want to be plugged into the international economy in the way that people in Mogadishu are, you've got to be in Mogadishu where there's connectivity. You can't be out in the countryside in Somalia. And so we've seen this really significant movement of population to cities that's driven in part by connectivity. And that connectivity actually shifts and changes the way that conflict happens. I'll give you two examples of that, and then I'm going to sort of summarize with some ideas about how to think about the environment. One of them is Libya, and the other one is in Syria. So in Libya in 2011, there was a very major fight in a coastal city called Misurata. And the French had a French naval task force offshore ready to intervene in the conflict. But they didn't really know very much about what was going on the ground. Now, this is a coastal city with an urbanized population, fairly well educated, and since 2003, Libyans have exploded in their access to things like cell phones and satellite phones and the internet. Libyan kids, school kids on the ground, were getting shot by regime snipers as they were trying to move around the city. So a bunch of Libyan schoolgirls began to use Google Earth and sat phones and Android cell phones to plot the locations of regime snipers that were shooting at them. So they would put like little pins on the map to show like, hey, there's a sniper in this building, don't go down that street. The French, sitting offshore, start to see all these pins appearing on Google Earth, and they're like, what is that? So they flew a reconnaissance mission and they figured out these are regime positions. So when they noticed that, they started obviously to bomb the regime positions. When the school kids realized, hey, if we mark something on the map, the French are going to bomb it, they went out and just marked every regime position they could find. And as soon as things were destroyed, they would start taking them down and they would disappear again from Google Earth. So what we had, if anybody's a targeter in the audience, what we had was a completely self-synchronized, crowdsourced bomb damage assessment system, right? Which I think the Pentagon spent literally billions of dollars trying to build one of those, but we've got school kids doing this on the ground now because they have access to connectivity. That would literally have been impossible 3-4 years ago. The technology wasn't there and the level of connectivity wasn't out there. As far as I can tell, talking to kids on the ground and talking to people that were in the French task force, at no time did they ever actually talk to each other. It was just completely self-synchronized. They started to figure it out based on what they could see together looking at Google Earth. Second example is a little more analog. In Syria last year, and we do a lot of work in Syria for a couple of aid agencies and an NGO, our guys started to see these little armored vehicles appearing. One of them was about 6 feet long and about 3 feet wide. It was built actually on a mini miner chassis with armor welded to the outside. This thing didn't have a turret. What it had was a machine gun mounted on top with an electric motor so that it could be controlled remotely from inside. It had a series of video cameras mounted on the outside, actually a GoPro, if you guys know what that is, like an action camera on the very top. And then inside was a flat screen TV. And the whole thing, both the driving of the vehicle and the control of the weapon system, was run through the flat screen television via a Game Boy game controller. This was built in a backyard workshop by a bunch of guys belonging to the Free Syrian Army. I showed this to some army guys about 6 months ago, and they said, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense to build such a tiny armored vehicle that only has a machine gun on it. But if you think about Aleppo, which is where this thing was built, if you try to take a Bradley or an Abrams, like American-style armored vehicles, or a BMP, which is what the Soviet, ex-Soviet vehicle that the regime uses, down a street in the back of Aleppo, you're not getting there because these streets are literally 4 or 5 feet wide. This thing doesn't have to confront other armored vehicles. It's not going to see them because they can't get there. It's designed specifically to operate in the back streets of an old medieval Arab town against infantry who can't maneuver because they don't have the ability to bring tanks to bear. This is basically perfectly adapted to the environment. Again, the technology to even build this thing wasn't out there until about 5 years ago. But now what you're looking at is a very tech-savvy, technologically literate population that, because they're urban, they're all concentrated, and they have access to things like the sorts of tools and systems you would need to make a tank in your backyard. Again, something that's not out there in Afghanistan, but what we see in most of the environments where we're likely to operate, this kind of urbanized, technically savvy population. Final example, in the US state of Georgia, in May of 2011, a 15-year-old ninth grade kid called Steen Kirby looked at the Libyans and thought, you know, these guys don't really know how to use the weapon systems that they're capturing from the regime. So he crowdsourced in about 48 hours a bilingual Arab-English AK-47 manual to teach the Libyans how to use the weapons that they were capturing. He got all the stuff from old Soviet websites and got his friends and got people that could speak Arabic and pulled together this document. That today is the major document that's used across most of Syria in the fighting against the regime. Because neither Syria nor Libya were really gun cultures. Again, if you've operated in Afghanistan or Iraq, you're dealing with people that came up in a gun culture, right? So everybody knows how to fire a weapon. Once I was sitting with an Afghan tribal elder, and I asked him about, you know, where the IED techniques come from, and he said, what do you mean? And he called over his 15-year-old son and said, hey, make me an IED. And the kid just started to, like, pull one together, like they just know how to do it. People in Libya and Syria don't come from that background. They were, you know, shopkeepers and university students before the uprising, so they didn't have that background. But now you've got a situation where a kid in the United States can take 48 hours and pull together a manual that's now the dominant document that people use, and people just download this repeatedly off the internet, and it's out there as one of the key elements of how people operate out in Syria. So I don't want to belabor this point too much, but I think it's really important to understand that not only do we need to re-engage with the urban environment because we've been kind of distracted by 10 years of doing something that's not going to be the future norm, but also in that time the world's changed and it's dramatically more connected than it ever was. So how do we understand that? And this is the sort of topic that I'll end on. How do you understand an urban environment that's under massive stress, that's producing violence and producing all kinds of other problems? And this is a pressing issue not only for people that live in Syria, but for us, because this is something that's going to be happening basically across the planet. And I go back to Karl Marx, actually, weirdly enough. So Marx, whatever else he was a social scientist, and he was looking at European cities at the end of the first 100 years of the Industrial Revolution. So Berlin and London and all these places that he was looking at were experiencing many of the same things that we see in third world coastal cities today. And so he looked at you know, the way that rapid urbanisation and lack of government services and marginalisation of communities and people getting alienated from the various systems that they need to access in order to survive, how that affects people. And when you take that and apply it to what you see on the ground in the third world today, there's actually a lot of similarities. But in the 1960s, a guy called Abel Wolman took one of Marx's ideas, the idea of urban metabolism, and wrote an article that's become very seminal in urban ecology, which is called The Metabolism of Cities. And Wolman basically says, just like a body has a metabolism, a city has a metabolism, right? You have various intakes, you know, carbon, fuel, air, people, you know, and as they come in, they get transformed by various processes, and it produces like the biomass of the city and the energy that the city needs to function, but it also produces toxic waste products. And the city needs to have the carrying capacity to metabolize or deal with those byproducts, or you're going to see the buildup of pollution. And this has become a really common analytical procedure in ecology now, looking at an urban environment and running what's called a material flow analysis to understand whether that environment has the carrying capacity to deal with the flow that it's experiencing. What I've done in the book, and I have a number of case studies of this, ranging from Jamaica to Mumbai to various other places that I worked for the book, what I've done is to do a non-material flow analysis. So instead of looking at carbon and water, looking at things like money and drugs and weapon systems and information and how they flow through an environment and what kinds of toxic byproducts, not pollution but usually violence, get generated by that, and what are the ways that a city can use to cope with those flows. And where I come down on this in the end is kind of paradoxical. It's that if you look at the problem set, the military really doesn't figure in your answer, right? There's really no military solution to the problem of rapid, unplanned urbanization across two-thirds of the planet, which is going to soak in, you know, 3 billion new people in the next generation, which is the same number of people that it took all of human history to generate across the entire planet right up until 1960. You could put a Marine regiment or an Army division or an Air Force Expeditionary Air Wing into one of those cities and it would just disappear. No one would probably even notice it was there. We're talking about, you know, cities like Lagos that will have 25 million people by 2040, the entire west coast of India being one single conurbation by 2040, you know, giant cities that you just can't engage with in a traditional military sense. By the way, there is a detailed appendix in the book where I get right into the tactics of how you would do that, but I think there's really no solution that involves the military going in. So a problem focus doesn't result in a military solution. That's like looking at a big city and saying the solution here is fire prevention. That doesn't help you if you're in the fire department, right? If you're in the fire department, your job is not to worry about fire prevention. Your job is to fight the goddamn fires when they break out, right? So you have to think, okay, what do I do when fire prevention fails? So the paradox is if you're in the military, although there's not a significant likelihood of a military solution to a lot of these things, there's a dead certainty that our political leaders will continue to send us into these environments because that's what they've been doing for the last 200 years in a way that's completely unaffected by policymakers' preferences, as I mentioned up front. So if you're in the military, you better understand how to operate in a very crowded, urbanized, coastal environment against a non-state actor who has access to democratized technology and connectivity that makes that adversary dramatically more lethal than anything we've really ever encountered before. So that's the environment that the military needs to be thinking about, and it has some really significant implications for the way we structure and the kinds of things we buy and the way we operate, and that's one whole side of the discussion. But the other side of the discussion is, what are we doing about the problem? Because the solution isn't necessarily military, and I think that it's much more a matter of resiliency and community-based co-design rather than governments coming in, patting people on the head, sort of telling them to sit down and shut up while we give them the solution. And I can talk in much more detail about some of the things that we've done as in my little company with World Bank and NGOs and so on in Africa and Latin America, trying to sort of test some ways that we might operate. Here in San Francisco, you've got a great company called IDEO, which pioneered a thing called human-centered design and has focused a lot on what I would call co-design, how you get outsiders who have certain kinds of technical knowledge and put them together with a community that understands a problem and comes up with innovative solutions that neither side could come up with. And I think some of the stuff that IDEO in particular have come up with is just brilliant. My challenge to them and what my people that work for me do every day is, how do you do that in an environment where people are shooting at you, where the level of violence is so high that you just can't sit down with people and have a conversation? And that's the sorts of places that we work. And unfortunately, I think it's where people in the military and law enforcement and in the aid community really need to be focused in terms of thinking about the future conflict environment. Because I've been very down for the last 20 minutes or so, I'm going to end on an up note, which is, it's not all bad, right? I mean, we're talking about 3 billion more people in urban environments by the middle of the century. Not only could that potentially be very good for the planet, right, it could really reduce pressure on the environment in some ways, but also we could be talking about 2 billion more people in the global middle class by the middle of the century, lifting people out of poverty, access to education, access to the means of economic prosperity. There's all kinds of upsides to this. If you're in business, there's a massive business opportunity here. I mean, these cities that we're talking about haven't even happened yet, and we're talking about the entire population of the planet in 1960 is going to need all kinds of stuff just to, you know, get by in these big cities. So there's a significant upside to this. And in fact, there's a lot of good research data which suggests that as cities get bigger, their adaptive capacity and their ability to handle these kinds of problems actually increases faster than the scale of the problems. But there are certain things you've got to have in place if that's going to occur. And one of those is the ability to free up adaptive resources and make people more resilient. So I think the solution is ultimately not to be thinking about how do we stop this human tide that's going to be flowing into environments on coastlines in the developing world in the next generation. It's thinking about how do we teach people to swim? You know, how do we think about urban resiliency in a different way that sort of exploits the kinds of adaptive capacity that are already out there and kind of helps people unlock that as a way to engage with these problems? So.
Oh, there you go. This is not just accidental stuff that we think happens once we are at war. I think this suggests to you this extraordinary amount of thinking way ahead of where people are about how to control them. And when you think about it, when he talked about the geographic issue of major cities being coastal cities for the most part. Well, you know, you think of places like New York City and just about along both the left coast and the right coast. And you see what the implications are, that inevitably, as populations grow and there will be a need to control them. And so what he's essentially preaching is a need for military people to fine-tune in anticipation of these things, to fine-tune the ways in which they can control what is going to be happening in these major, or he called them mega cities. I hope it was instructive. We'll take a little break, come back, and talk about the National Day of Mourning. Right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead, and tomorrow the nation will be observing Thanksgiving Day, and I think we all know what a farce that is. We know, of course, what it signifies. The distorted history of the United States would have us believe this is when the Puritans and the Native Americans sat down together and broke bread and all was wonderful and fine and there was peace in the land and justice and equality and all that other kind of nonsense. But I join with the community in calling it the National Day of Mourning. And a day, I think, since most people will not be working on that day, to use a day in a kind of contemplative exercise to ask ourselves, are we doing okay with being useful in the world as agents of change? In this dog-eat-dog, I-got-mine-you-get-yours world where we are, encouraged strictly to think in terms of self, I, me, and mine. And do we really have reason to feel all right about what we are doing in our own lives to benefit people in the broadest sense of the word? I'd like to know what you're thinking and how you measure or assess yourselves. 888-874-4888. Let me hear from you about what you think you are doing to advance this notion that we're all in the soup together, and to the degree that we can assist and help, in what way can we assist and help? How far along are we on that path? I mean, everybody's going to say, well, I'm really working hard at it. But to be truthful about it, it is not easy to maintain that kind of a spirit in this day and age. The pressures are so heavy, urging us to be more and more concerned with self, less and less concerned with others. And I've talked all the time about this zero-sum mentality, that it is fine for me to have, and it means that you won't have. That's the kind of world we live in, that it all balances out. We make these weird equations. The reason I have makes me feel okay about the fact that you don't. And so, as agents of change, I mean, we cross all these different lines all the time during the day. We talk to all kinds of people. We see all kinds of things in our neighborhoods where we work and so forth. And every now and then, does it cross your mind to ask yourself, gee, I mean, what am I really doing about the bigger picture? How do I fit in? Or are we contented with the idea that we have so much to manage for ourselves, we don't have the resources, the energy, the time, the skill to give to anything or anyone because we're all tapped out? There's nothing more that we could do except concentrate on ourselves. In other words, to what degree in our daily lives do we find ourselves confronting that silly mentality, this business of rugged individualism, that you take care of yourself, you take care of those who are close to you, and that's as big as it ought to be. That's as important as it ought to be. Nothing else. Because it's up to everyone to see his or her way through life. And if they don't do it, it must be because they're made of inferior material. And that's too bad, because we are not. You know, that kind of attitude. I see it all the time. I see it all the time. Even in the progressive community, the idea that, look, I'm doing my thing over here, you better find your own way. And there's a lot of talk. I mean, we could talk about the needs of others, but we also have, at the end of it all, to demonstrate that we are committed to the needs of others. What are your thoughts? 888 874-4888. Just, in fact, as I am on the topic, let me remind you that tomorrow Of course, there would be a repeat of a program. I think it's going to be the same for other programs as well, so that people can have time with their families. I like that idea that you have time to do some fellowshipping with the people close to you, and to just contemplate this question about family. Family not just being the organic family, you know, that you're born into, but the family that you create as well. You know, what is your relationship to family, your commitment to family, in the small sense, of course, but in the largest sense, in the largest scheme of things? How useful are you to the larger family? And what does it take for you to do that? How have you struggled with this? And it would be good to know. So I'm waiting for your call at 888-874-4888. So tomorrow, be prepared, if you are listening, that you'll be hearing a program, a repeat program, and then we come back to each other on Friday, as usual. All right? Good. So, I wanted to comment, in the meantime, on these four things that the presentation referred to. David Kilcullen, K-I-L-C-U-L-L-E-N, Kilcullen was the speaker. And he was talking, of course, as a soldier and as a counterterrorism expert, he was talking to military types. And he talked about the fact that there is going to be a dramatic shift, and that the military, the ways of containing these massive urbanized settings where you will have millions of people living, but he talked about the fact not just that they would be living there, but there's also the possibility that within this group of people living in these cities would be groups that intend to wage a kind of urban or guerrilla warfare. That's what he's talking about. In fact, the book is titled Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. So it is anticipating that in the major cities, there would be an element or elements within it that would be, as he called them, a non-state group, as regular people organized for one reason or the other, from the military perspective seen as anti-state. So how do you control them? And more than that, how do you contain them? How do you annihilate them? And you have to prepare. So when we put these dots together, we can see that these things are not happening just by chance, that the militarization of police departments across the United States ever increasingly taking on both the look and the operations and the weapons and the mentality of war in major cities. In fact, you hear police commissioners and so forth very often talking about that. You know, this is a kind of war. Hello, Sonia from the Bronx. You're on the air.
Hi, Utrecht. Hello. Show. I just wanted to share with you that I feel deeply moved by the conditions of people all over the world, and I try to contribute to change by remaining enlightened and educated and sharing what I've learned with others. I try to donate to worthy charitable organizations. I try to share what I have in terms of food and vitamins and knowledge. I often buy vitamins for myself and give them away to people who may benefit. And when I go to the supermarket and I'm privileged enough to buy, you know, good food for myself And for my family, I often ask to contribute to a food bank. And so in those ways, I try to make a change, make an effort to help others. And certainly there are many more ways that I can help. And I'm hoping to be able to do that as I free myself from being caught up in the system and the routine that we all live under here in the United States.
That's fantastic. That's quite admirable. Is this something that you came to yourself, or is this something you emulating from your own family?
Well, my mother was a very religious person, and always believed in giving and sharing and in tithing and the rule of tithing, where you contribute part of your salary to mm-hmm. others, although we had very little to contribute, but what we had, we were willing to share. And so I have that upbringing to go back to, and I just hate to see people suffering. I hate to see people hungry for whatever reasons there may be, whether it's self-induced or caused by, unforeseen circumstances. It doesn't matter. I just don't want to live in a world where I'm surrounded by so much suffering. It's just not a happy place to be, regardless as to how much I have. I don't have that much, but at least I have a home and I have food and I have my health, and I'm very grateful for that. And I show my gratitude by trying to help others, although there's certainly much, much more that I could do, and I'm hoping to be able to do that in the coming year.
Well, that's great. That's fantastic. I really congratulate you about that, and hopefully you will be a beacon to others to just, as you say, move away from that pattern of I, me, and mine, and be more concerned about what's going on in your own environment. That's real leadership.
And in the global environment, it's just everywhere. The suffering is everywhere, and it's just getting mm-hmm. worse, I think. But it's getting worse because we're allowing it to get worse.
I think so, but it's really important. People think that you have to be a big leader with a big L.
No.
You just have to be effective right where you are.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so much that could be done from home. I ask people if they need money or food, or I give clothing or furniture or whatever, is available to me to share. Is what I really try to focus on. And, of course, sometimes I become diverted because I'm stressed out because of work or because of whatever, commuting or the high price of milk, But, that's not so important. Those things are temporary. The bigger picture is making change for everyone, for ourselves and for everyone around us. It's the only way we're going to have peace and enjoy our lives.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the wonderful show. I've been listening to you for many, many years, including when you were on WBAI, but I'm so happy that you joined, PRN, and I think you do a fantastic job.
Oh, thank you so much for your encouragement. I could use it. Thanks so much. Thank you very much.
It's well deserved. Thank you, Trees.
Thank you, Sonia. 888-874-4888. It's important. You don't have to go to some college and be anointed with a degree in being generous and effective in your own neighborhood. You can just start doing it just by yourselves. You see a need, you respond to the best of your ability. And if we all do that, it would be great. We help out each other in that way. Hello, Mike from Michigan. How are you?
Hi, Treat. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, I got involved with a lot of political stuff, but I don't think I'm going to do it because everybody that I got elected kind of turned on me and went to other directions. So I just think I'm just going to go try to help people individually as I can.
Great. What are you going to do?
I just go out every day and just see what I can do. And my daughter goes to college in Detroit, and I just go out and onto the campus and the kids, because I don't know if you realize it, and the kids are eating nothing but garbage now. and they're all wearing Nike, and they all got the designer phones, and I just try to tell them, you know, you're coming here for education, but you're supporting the people who outsourced your jobs, and I just get a blank stare.
Yeah, you would, because that kind of education is not being taught.
No, and it's kind of a shame, because the kids are eating nothing but garbage, and the young ladies and the pants and the tops are so tight, and my daughter would never get out of the house dressed like that, but I don't know why the parents let them dress like that. It's just, you know, it's just kind of sad, but you just got to keep on going forward. And I notice a lot of great people like you around, and we just got to keep going at it.
Yeah, it's important to care. It's also important to see things in perspective. I mean, every generation has had an issue with the previous one regarding their customs and their clothing and whatever else. So we keep in mind that young people are young people. And we also keep in mind the fact that education has not been that comprehensive. They're not taught about what it takes to be a good citizen. They don't get educated, even at home sometimes, about what it means to be mindful of others. In fact, they see the exact opposite. You know, it's just about us and, you know, the heck with everybody else.
And just teach my son, everybody that you came across are going to come across, they all came from a different place, and there's a learning lesson with each individual. And I don't think that's even taught. We all came from a different place, and we can learn from each other.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I absolutely think so.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you for a great show.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
well, the show is all of us.
Yes.
You know, we all get together here and have a good chat. Thanks so much.
I'm not going to celebrate Thanksgiving either. I'm just probably going to meditate the whole day. So.
Yeah, well, you know, give some thought, but also, I mean, it's a great thing to be with family. I like that concept.
Yes.
Just take it one step further and talk about, well, you know, how accountable are we not only to each other, but to the community, to people who are in need? In what ways are we doing that as a family? Thanks again for your call. Well, tomorrow, again, it's great to be with family, whether you're the family you're born into or the family you create. It's great to be together. It's great to share good thoughts and good times. But it's also a day, I think, somewhere during the day, you give some thought to people who are suffering, people who can use some help, and people who can use your compassion, your generosity, your kindness, your consideration, your love. It's a very, very important thing to do as activists, and I think we all want to be activists. So thank you so much. Again, tomorrow, a repeat program, and we come back to each other here on Friday. I hope today's program was instructive. It was kind of frightening, but it is something that we ought to keep in mind about how these urban centers are being transformed, and along with that transformation, the collateral preparation on the part of the military. It's really scary. But see you on Friday. Thanks. Mm-hmm.